Wouldn't that be interesting? On some days, it's hard to believe that I ever lived in a world that operated on such extreme notions of self-annihilation. But then I turn on the news, read a few articles, and realize that what I have experienced may have been unique, but in no way was it disconnected from history. Minorities continue to be abused and manipulated by both nefarious and well-intentioned groups of people, and harmful ideas continue to develop new political strains all over the world. What I can't quite understand, and what I may never be capable of understanding, is how we all came to be mixed up in the ex-gay movement. What drew each of us to Love in Action's double doors? There are no pictures to help me search for clues, so I developed them myself. I picture Smid walking away from his first wife, leaving everything behind. I picture Jay forging a new identity in the face of an angry father. I picture my mother, her former life disappearing as she stands beside her new preacher husband on the stage, perhaps remembering the child she once lost in the hospital, perhaps thinking about me. Again and again, I picture the lie chair. I see my father and the chair. I see him as a child, watching his father tie his mother to the dining room chair and beat her. I see how he must have cowered, crouching from his own father. Then, decades later, there he is, sitting in a padded hospital chair beside my grandfather's bed after alcoholism has taken everything from this man's body, the only one of his siblings to visit the dying old man. Always I circle back to my father. I picture him clutching the invalid hand. I picture him crying silently, waiting to say goodbye. There is a mystery in this, a minor apocalypse somewhere between what these two men once knew of themselves, a holding on to something that, in turn, refused to let them go. And I long to know it, like the old prophets. Epilogue. Smid's voice emerges from the darkness, enclosing me in its soft, lilting syllables. I'm lying in my bed in a tiny apartment in Auburn, Alabama, 2 years into a master's degree in creative writing, winding down from a night of researching restoration drama by listening to a podcast of This American Life, Ira Glass's voice a haven of liberal thinking in a deeply conservative state, when suddenly, as if some cold hand has reached out of the past to clench my throat, Smid's voice draws me back to Love in Action. "John, you don't have to live like this anymore," the voice says. It's a recording from one of Smid's many appearances on an evangelical television show. In the interview, Smid quotes God, whose voice once told him that he needed to become straight, that this would only be possible if Smid followed God's orders. I grope in the darkness beside my bed for the lamp and switch it on. The light burns my eyes. This can't be happening. This private shame made public. I feel strangely protective of the information, as if no one but me has the right to hear this kind of talk. The tone of the This American Life interview is winking, with knowing phrases that betray a liberal audience accustomed to joking about one of those Christian places that claims they can cure homosexuality. It's the tone of so many of my professors, people so far removed from the conservative Christian perspective that they can't help but sound flippant, many of their lives padded by families who've supported them since they were toddlers. I stand up beside the bed, dots swimming in my eyes, orange and yellow streaks swirling across the mostly bare white walls. Nails mark the places where I've just removed photos of me and my last boyfriend, a reminder of the many casualties suffered in a long string of withering intimacies, advances made and accepted, but rebuffed once things got too serious. No one is going to get close enough to hurt me. But now here it is. This voice I've tried hard to forget, reaching through the barriers I've erected to declare a truth that arrives a decade too late to make better what at one point in my life felt as though it could never be made better. The transformation for the vast majority of homosexuals will not include a change of sexual orientation. As if this is all it takes. Smid's admitting to the obvious lie he'd sold me and my family to repair the damages inflicted on all of us. As if this could make up for the near decade of confusion and self-doubt that followed the collapse of my faith. This is the first of many public apologies. Over the next few years, ex-gay counselors will continue to admit their wrongs, pose for magazine photos, readily accept opportunities for interviews. Exodus International, the umbrella company Love in Action worked under, will disband, and in its wake only a few ex-gay facilities will continue their operations, none of them ever as big or prevalent as Love in Action, though a few dogged evangelicals will export ex-gay thinking to places like Uganda. The popular story arc will be one of redemption, the tyrant turned reformer. These ex-gay counselors will even write books. Smid will write a memoir, X'd Out, publish it at a vanity press, and pitch it in many of his interviews. In his biography at the back of the book, he'll include words that, though partially true by the time he writes them, will cause my entire body to shake from anger. Whether he is dealing one-on-one with an individual, a family, or speaking in churches or seminars worldwide, John's message of openness and honesty resonates with everyone who longs to be accepted, loved, and understood. It will take years before I find the strength to finish the pages of my own story, before I can even approach my memories. I will return to my parents' house from time to time, acting like a stranger. In these moments, my mother will drag me down to the hell my parents had been living in all those years since I left them to insecurity and doubt, and the fear that they've committed an unforgivable act from which they can never recover. "You two have to deal with this directly," my mother will say, pointing first to my father, then to me. I refuse to be in the middle anymore. But I will refuse her request. I will refuse to even look at my father, the man with whom, post-LIA, I've primarily communicated through brief emails and one-sentence answers. I will rush out of the room, enter my old bedroom, and slam the door. I will fall against the soft mattress and stare up at the popcorn ceiling and run my hands over the high thread count, bury my face in the coolness of a freshly laundered bed, my parents still talking in hushed voices on the other side of the door. This call and response of blame that must have settled so gradually into their years of talking that they no longer find it as shocking as it is to me. In order to escape the sound, I will stand up and begin rifling through my closet for the great books collection I'd bought in my overzealous classics phase. Touching the gold-fringed pages, it will just begin to dawn on me how close I came to losing my passion, to losing my life. In the years since LIA, I've had to spend so much time catching up with other people, learning how to believe in a world that no longer teems with angels and demons. Every time I've read a book or ingested a new historical fact that my Baptist upbringing taught me to reject, I've had to fight against the sneaking suspicion that I am being led astray by Satan. In the message boards and hidden ex-gay Facebook groups I will join, I'll see others talking about their own attempted suicides, and I'll glimpse in these confessions elements so remarkably similar to my own that they will seem, for a moment, to issue directly from my mind. I will see people talk about losing their families, about the yearly trials they faced as winter holidays approached and the loneliness threatened to overwhelm them once again. "Sometimes I just want to die," one member of the ex-gay group will tell me. "When I think about how difficult it is just to get through a day, trying to act normal. I've forgotten how to be myself," another man will write. "How did I even act before ex-gay therapy? When I try to remember, I keep thinking maybe I'm wrong. They did that to me. They made me question my sanity. I don't even talk to my family anymore," one woman will write. "They still think I need more therapy. I think they'd rather see me dead." The chorus of voices will grow each year, revealing decades of pain, decades lost, families torn apart, relationships ruined because people outside the ex-gay world can never understand what we patients went through. On Beyond Ex-Gay, a website dedicated to surveying ex-gay survivors, users will describe in painstaking detail the lasting effects of reparative therapy. "It elevated sexuality from being part of my life to being the central fact of my life. Everything revolved around it and my fear of it and being discovered." Multiple suicide attempts, 2 psychiatric hospitalizations, diagnosed severe type 2 bipolar disorder and moderate PTSD by multiple doctors in 2 different states. Ex-gay therapists told me the symptoms from these illnesses were caused by my sexual confusion. 11 years later, I still sometimes get nauseous when touching another man. It is difficult, possibly impossible, to maintain a long-term sexual relationship. "I really lost touch with myself all those years, because I was so busy trying to be someone else. I am now confused about nearly everything, God, faith, where I belong, where I should go from here. I have lost friends. I often feel hopeless. I am trying to get my life back on track. I will open the LIA handbook, read a few sentences, and feel the old shame wash over me until I can no longer focus. Once again, Smid's voice will swallow my own before I have a chance to say anything. I'll face doubt, distrust my memories, spend hours trying to reconstruct scenes so charged with emotion they'll seem impossible to pin down. I'll call my mother to ask for details, sit with her at a table and record her words, and nearly every time one of us will end up in tears. My mother will apologize again and again. I will try to comfort her, but I'll fail, because all of it truly was as horrible as we remember it. And because it will never really go away, we will never be completely okay. Our family will never be what it otherwise might have been. And God. I will not call on God at any point during this decade-long struggle. Not because I want to keep God out of my life, but because his voice is no longer there. What happened to me has made it impossible to speak with God, to believe in a version of him that isn't charged with self-loathing. My ex-gay therapists took him away from me, and no matter how many different churches I attend, I will feel the same dead weight in my chest. I will feel the pang of a deep love now absent from my life. I will continue to experiment with different denominations, different religions. I will continue to search. And even if I no longer believe in hell, I will continue to struggle with the fear of it. Perhaps one day I will hear his voice again. Perhaps not. It's a sadness I deal with on a daily basis. One day, when we think most of the pain is over, my mother will phone to inform me that a deacon from our old church refused to invite my father to preach at a revival service because a man stood up in protest during the middle of a church meeting, claiming that my father's openly homosexual son signified a spiritual lapse in my father's ministry. My parents will tell me that if I write this book, my father will risk losing his job as a pastor. The sins of the father. Every step in my success will become a reminder of ex-gay ideology. Every step in my success will become an immediate threat to my father's. Years later, I will call my father one afternoon to let him know that this book is the book I have to write. That I might not be okay if I don't finally write it. That I won't know who I am until I finish it. I just want you to be happy, my father will say, his voice tight with everything he refuses. I really do. And I will believe him. This is Michael Crouch. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Boy Erased, a Memoir, by Garrett Conley. This program was directed by Scott Cresswell. Executive producer, Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2016 by Garrett Conley. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.